From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations and comments featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the second of two discussions about medicine and the hospital in history. What are the origins and precedents for institutional medical care as it exists in America today? What do physicians and historians of medicine and hospitals foresee regarding American medical care? The panelists for Soundings are Timothy Miller, Donald Madison, and Michael McVaugh. Tim Miller and Michael McVaugh are historians of medicine. Michael McVaugh at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Tim Miller at Salisbury State College in Maryland. Don Madison is a physician who teaches in the medical school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he is a professor of social and administrative medicine. Tim Miller recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a research project entitled The Birth of the Hospital in Medieval Byzantium. Tim Miller tells me that the idea of socialized medicine, however you care to define that, isn't anything that's really new.
Well, I've got a hedge on that question. If you define socialized medicine in terms of control by the government beyond setting up sort of legal definition of what a physician is, I mean, that seems to have come in fairly early, even in Byzantium by the 12th century. If you mean that there was a lot of control and legislation by the government and a bureaucracy to supervise physicians, then socialized medicine didn't exist in medieval Eastern Roman Empire. But it would seem that the purpose of these hospitals was to make access to physicians available. For example, if there wasn't room in the wards, you could at least see the physicians assigned to the outpatient clinic for free again, so that there was a walk-in clinic that anyone that felt a little sick that day could go and wait in line and get free medical care. So in that sense, there was free medical care available to anyone that wanted it. At the same time, the physicians who worked in the hospitals had 6 months off, as I said, alternating, you know, January, March, May, to practice privately, to see patients and to make some of them a bundle of money. But at the same time, to maintain their status, they were willing to treat patients for free during the other 6 months.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that until recently, the largest part of a society's aggregate expenditure on medical care by whatever means was not in hospitals, but probably directly to physicians. And it's only relatively recently, with the growth of technology and the almost exponential expansion of hospital personnel and labor costs, et cetera, that the bulk of the medical care dollar in our society and other Western societies is now spent, controlled by physicians to be sure, but spent on hospital care. So if hospital care in other times was free, that certainly didn't mean that the population necessarily had access to free medical care when the bulk of that medical care dollar or shekel or whatever it was spent not on hospitals anyway, but on physicians for their services.
I would think that for most of the history of hospitals in the West, the general public would avoid the hospital if possible, because whatever class you're in, poor, chronically ill, acutely ill, the chances are good that once you go in the hospital, you're not going to come out. Now, I think today we like to think that that's true. We have a more positive view of what the hospital can do for us, and that whether or not it's entirely borne out, I'm not sure. But I say that teasingly. But certainly in earlier times, you avoid the hospital if at all possible.
You commented earlier, Michael, about hospitals being a place where people really wouldn't want to go. Were hospitals always looked on as places where you would just go to die?
If not to die, to be incarcerated. The leprosaria, for example, in the West, which are, I think, the clearest example of institutions with a strictly for just for the ill. I mean, if you go to a leprosarium, you're not going to come out again, and you find the patient appealing, beseech physician, give them a certificate saying that they've just got some miscellaneous skin disease, it's not really leprosy, so that they won't be put away, isolated, and kept there. You know, you're going there to die maybe in 30 years, but you're going there, you'll stay there the rest of your life. And in some sense, that's, I think, characteristic of most people's expectations in these hospitals.
Let's talk about another unpleasant subject, money. When does the commercial impulse enter into the rise of hospitals?
Well, that's a question I'd like to ask, and Don Madison's already clarified it for me to some extent. I didn't realize it was as late as the late 19th and early 20th century. I mean, I would suspect that every administrator of a Christian hospital should be asking himself today, why don't we provide philanthropic care? I mean, why would anybody come to our emergency room be expected to have Blue Cross Blue Shield?
Well, that's a question that I don't know whether you'd call them administrators, but the people who were involved in running the hospitals must have asked historically.
Well, as hospital costs went up, they still had to raise money, and their former sources of money, the contributions of wealthy people, were not up to the task of the amount of money that they needed. So they began to. They began to charge patients' fees. I think it's been a steady progression of in the direction of running them as businesses ever since.
You know, when you think of the way in which technology, diagnostic technology, for example, has become more expensive in the last 170, 150 years, I don't know if it really has brought home to you that. You begin, let's say, with Lennox stethoscope in 1820, which is a cylinder of wood with a hole bored through it. That's not so expensive. That's a technology which you can probably, you're not going to have to charge the patients much for that. But how much does it cost a hospital today, Don, for a CAT scanner, for that sort of diagnostic, which is already perhaps becoming obsolete? How much money in sort of investment is involved in that?
I don't know.
Hundreds of thousands?
At least.
To provide the sort of medical care which is possible, both in diagnosis and treatment, just costs, dialysis machines, just cost incredible sums. It strikes, well, Don can speak more authoritatively to it. It strikes me that it's a question which we all ought to address and think about. You may be getting what you pay for, but we may also want to decide whether we want what we get, whether it's worth the price we pay, because we spend, I heard the figure quoted the other day, of paying 9% of our gross national product on medical care with no sign that this is ending. I mean, how much money do we want to put into hospital care, medical care at all levels? You'll get something back for it, but at some point, don't we have to stop it? That's not a problem that the Middle Ages had.
Patients get what they pay for. The problem is that they don't decide what they get.
It seems to me, though, I want to bring back to the issue to philanthropy and say that, of course, costs have gone up. But at the same time costs have gone up, there hasn't been a concomitant growth of philanthropia, as the Byzantines would say, or sense of Christian charity. Now, I'm not maintaining that it would be possible for churches to stimulate their members to an outpouring of philanthropy to match all the expenses. But I certainly think something like that could be begun. I don't know when was the time that I've heard a sermon in churches that I've gone to really stimulating us to contribute to the local hospital, in a Catholic hospital in my case. We might get sermons about, vague sermons about the church is for the poor and so forth. But I haven't heard it specified that one way that a church can make it clear that it's serving the poor is to make a real effort that their hospitals are philanthropic. Now, they might want to set guidelines on that. The Byzantine hospitals, as I say, seem to have been totally open to any comer, including rich people. What I suspect happened in the case of Byzantine hospitals was when a man was a wealthy person, and there seemed to have been advantages to going to hospitals over home care. I didn't bring this out, but there's good evidence that the emperor himself withdrew to a hospital for care when he fell ill. Now, I don't have an example of a rich private citizen going to a public hospital in Constantinople, and I doubt that was done. But at least the emperor maintained a small hospital for himself and his family when they fell ill, whether it had to do with the way it was lit or heated or whatever. The physicians wanted to get him into a hospital environment for treatment. We can rule out the CAT scanners and so forth, but there was something there they thought would be better for the emperor. So anyway, what I do think happened, if a wealthy person was cured at a hospital or a person of middle class income later struck it big, he might mention the hospital in his will. As a result of this philanthropic service, he might leave half his property to the hospital, that sort of thing. Today, of course, we wouldn't think of doing that because often we grumble and complain every time we go to the hospital when we get the bill, rather than think, well, when I die, I'm going to see that hospital gets a good chunk of my property.
Surely it ought, this is, in a way, it takes us a little afield, but what we're interested in, too, is the social and the broader social and political climate that affects the way in which we pay for medical care. And certainly the impulse to philanthropy has weakened in proportion as as political organization, as the state, has taken over those functions and has begun routinely to get money from citizens to fulfill philanthropic purposes. In Byzantium, I take it that the emperor wouldn't, there is no estate tax, and part of that estate can indeed be passed to the hospital. In here, for example, there's an estate tax, and money will be passed to the state and then presumably given back, and is given in various ways for philanthropic purposes. There's one of the things I think that changes patterns of philanthropy from the 19th to the 20th century is the introduction of the income tax, which allows the state, encourages people to allow the state to take over functions, philanthropic functions that private individuals in the 19th century would have taken over.
Hospitals have only really made money, there are exceptions to this, of course, in large scale, or that is, had the potential to make money, probably since 1965 in the United States. 1965 was the enactment of the Medicare Act, which was the first large-scale social insurance, that is, government-sponsored insurance program in the United States. And the additional amounts of money flowing through the system added to the kinds of incentives that hospitals do not have to save money, that is, they can pass their costs on to whatever third parties, insurance schemes, are paying them, have added to the total costs and the total charges in ways that make it lucrative for some of them to be in business. And as a result, we have, beginning in the early 1970s and spreading through the late 70s and even now, the rise of proprietary chains of hospitals, corporate investment in for-profit hospitals.
Hospitals, as we were saying earlier, until the 20th century, really haven't been concerned to make money. They have been charitable, in large part charitable institutions. Physicians are, I think, raise different questions. My impression would be, Don, that in the 19th century, at least in the United States, there is a considerable oversupply of physicians, and many of them are just barely scraping along, that it's not all that easy you may be able to survive, but you're not making, you don't expect to make lots of money if you are a general practitioner in the 19th century.
Until almost 1920, there was a great oversupply of physicians.
I think throughout history, up until the 20th century, it's been rather chancy what you can expect as a physician. If you establish a good reputation, and if you're lucky enough to live in an urban setting where there is a wealthy clientele, those things combine, and you can probably do reasonably well in the, but there is certainly in the 14th century, at the beginnings of some sort of professional medical practice in the West, there is a considerable range in what physicians charge. There is a considerable, the sorts of fees they expect or negotiate for, because medicine is a contractual arrangement. You arrange in advance how much you're going to be paid for this treatment or that.
On the basis of the case.
On the basis of the case, and on the basis of what you think the patient will pay, and similarly on the basis of what you think the physician will accept. Wealthier patients, generally speaking, pay more, and they, generally speaking, seek out physicians who have had some sort of success. This is all complicated by the fact that for a very long time there is really no mechanism to ensure payment. And I think this is true too down to the 19th century, that physicians found it routinely very difficult to collect the fees that they would expect.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second of two discussions about medicine and the hospital in history. The panelists are Donald Madison, Michael McVaugh, and Timothy Miller. Don Madison is a professor of social and administrative medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Tim Miller and Michael McVaugh are historians of medicine. Tim Miller at Salisbury State College in Maryland, Michael McVaugh at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Tim Miller recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming book entitled The Birth of the Hospital in Medieval Byzantium. Here is Don Madison.
Interestingly, in the very early 20th century, there was a great growth in the number of hospitals, and perhaps the majority of those were profit-making hospitals. And I'm guessing, I don't know this, but I suspect that they didn't really make profit. They were by and large owned for physicians and started because those physicians couldn't obtain access to the larger, more prestigious voluntary hospitals that already existed. And a disproportionate number of them were located in rural areas, particularly in the South and in the Midwest. Interesting anecdote from a book called The Horse and Buggy Doctor by a Kansas physician, Arthur Hertzler, who spoke about his day as a Kansas practitioner and noted the rise of these small proprietary hospitals, which he labeled an epidemic. He said that in one town there were five such hospitals, the number, interestingly enough, being equal to the number of physicians who practiced there. But they were started because the physicians had to have them in order to compete with the city doctors who had access to hospitals and to whom they would otherwise lose patients and be out perhaps the margin of difference in making a living or not.
Am I right in remembering that when health insurance, national health insurance, is discussed in 1917, 1918, one of the physicians are initially, I think, broadly in favor of it, and one reason being that it's a way to ensure the payment that wasn't always forthcoming. Does that recollection ring?
The more elite physicians are at first in favor of it. The American Medical Association, until about that time, and its origins came from among the elite physicians, and its main mission was to upgrade the others into, or else get rid of them, into the elite group. So it's difficult to say that most of the physicians were in favor of it. But the American Medical Association at first was.
Going back to ancient times, and by ancient, this time I mean not the medieval Byzantine Empire, but way back to classical Greece and classical Rome, we know that some physicians in the 3rd century BC, 2nd century BC, were quite wealthy. They made a lot of money and were aristocrats in the towns of Asia Minor, so that physicians could make a lot of money at some time in society. What seems to have happened, as late in fact as the early Byzantine Empire, some physicians were still quite wealthy and influential. They often, through their close relationship to the emperor or to his officials as their private physicians, could become very, very influential people. In the Byzantine Empire proper, say, post-6th century, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, it seems that the physicians were making less money, but again, the only evidence I have is the salaries from the hospitals. We have no evidence of how much they made in private practice, and they could have been making quite a lot. Certainly, they were a influential group in government circles, again, because some of the physicians attached to the emperor's court and so forth would be in a position to influence policy. And as late in the 14th century, we have a parody of the Byzantine court in which the physicians are made fun of. They no longer are that interested, according to this particular satire, in Galen or Hippocrates or removing organs and so forth, operations, but rather with advising the emperor and getting big promotions in politics, we'll call it.
How would you characterize in historical or contemporary terms the interdependence between the physician and the hospital? Is one more important to the other than it would be the other way around?
Well, it's my contention, and this is will probably be, let's say, raise some people will disagree, that the hospital was crucial to the development of the medical profession in the East Roman Empire from the 6th to the 13th century at least, and still was important in the 13th, 14th, and 15th century, though their Western physicians and their their practice centered on private practice became an important model for Byzantine physicians. They were falling behind in the 14th century. But let's say up to the beginning of the 13th century, the Byzantine medical profession was centered on the hospital. That's my hypothesis.
Whereas I think my feeling would be that in the West, the existence of hospitals hasn't made much difference to medical practice, to the nature of medicine, until growing the 19th century, the beginning of the 19th century, and I suggested France earlier, but it's not really until the end of the century that there is some sort of symbiosis between the hospital and medicine.
And then I think it's important to point out more in the United States than any other Western country, because it's still the case in Western Europe that the general practitioners, by and large, do not practice in hospitals. It's only the specialists who practice in hospitals and who are the full-time employees of those hospitals, while in the United States, most physicians practice in hospitals, and the vast majority of them are not employees of the hospital, but depend on the hospital for a good part of their livelihood.
What's on the horizon for hospitals? Are they going to change? I realize this is a tricky question, asking you to gaze into the crystal ball. Are hospitals healthy? Are they going to survive as we know them?
Well, that has a lot to do with current policy and policy that is on the horizon. Most observers agree that not having been able to control the growth of hospital beds, and I'm talking about the United States, in the United States, we have too many. We know that they cost a lot of money, whether they're empty or whether they're full. There are movements afoot now in the Congress to sharply curtail the amount of money that will be paid by the federal government's financing mechanisms, and presumably other private sources of insurance would follow the federal government's lead, the amount of money paid to hospitals with incentives, for example, to restrict that on a per-case basis, depending on the type of case. They would get a set amount, no more and no less, and it would create an incentive for them to keep the patient in a shorter time, to order less of the more expensive tests and procedures, and so on. In addition, there is a movement afoot called health maintenance organizations. Health maintenance organizations are groups of physicians, either organized in formal group practice arrangements or in loose networks of independent practitioners. The important thing is that they are paid in such a way that they collectively take the risk for the amount of total expenditures that are made by or on behalf of their patients for health care. The main way they can save money is to limit the amount of, both in terms of number of admissions and length of stay, of hospitalizations. All of this, it seems to me, spells trouble ahead for hospitals in keeping their beds occupied to the degree that they've been used to keeping them occupied in the past. I don't know what will happen, but there will be interesting political tensions, particularly between physicians and hospitals in the coming days, the like of which I don't believe we've seen ever.
Now, I think it strikes me that you might look at the history of the hospital as the function of the hospital as in a way static until the middle of the 19th century, and then entering a steady progression after that. It would be wrong, I think, to see a natural advance towards the modern hospital. The long view is probably, from a historian 500 years hence, is probably going to look back at the 100 years after 1875, 150 years after 1875, as a period of enormous and consistent change in the nature and function of the hospital until it sorts out what its role is likely to be. I suspect we're in the middle of a reorganization of the role of the hospital that isn't over yet.
And just to follow up on my comments about philanthropic medicine linked to the Christian churches and also to other religious groups too, I think especially though, and I'm more familiar with the Christian tradition, I think that hospitals run by Christian denominations have to really do some serious thinking about what kind of business they're in. It would certainly have outraged St. Basil to see a hospital in which where profit was the factor. And I don't know how, for example, the Catholic Church and its many orders that in fact run hospitals are going to get rid of the hospitals if they can't run philanthropic medical programs. I think there'll be a lot of pressure put on Catholic hospitals to become public hospitals, to offer those services, because the rhetoric now is such that the service to the poor is supposedly the main virtue of a Catholic Christian, and you certainly aren't doing that when you're turning people away and sending them to the public hospital, because St. James somewhere can't take in a poor patient. That's really a disgrace to the tradition, I would view it as.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the second of two discussions about medicine and the hospital in history. The panelists were Timothy Miller of Salisbury State College and Michael McVaugh and Donald Madison of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about politics and culture in the modern American South. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for the second of two discussions about medicine and the hospital in history. A panel that includes medical historians and a professor of social and administrative medicine examines the origins of institutional health care. Does the concept of socialized medicine, for instance, have precedence? When historically does the commercial impulse become part of health maintenance? What of philanthropy? And how has the relationship between doctors and hospitals changed from ancient to modern times? Finally, what modifications in healthcare do doctors and medical historians foresee? Medicine and the Hospital in History, Part 2, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.